What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Ambassador Nancy Brinker, the founder and CEO of the Susan G. Komen for the Cure Foundation, which has done more for breast cancer awareness and research funding than any other organization in the world. We'll also have visits with our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@Yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Last Sunday, a week ago today, I was looking for a place to take my kids for a fast food lunch when one of them mentioned that Chick-fil-A was closed on Sundays. Seriously, I asked them? A fast food place that's closed on Sundays? One of the biggest fast food days of the week? Sure, they said. But being a rabbi and a skeptical Jew, especially about what my teenagers tell me, I had to confirm it. And it turned out to be true. Chick-fil-A is in fact closed on Sundays. Even the voicemail doesn't pick up. So I looked it up online and found on their website the following message. Of the many unique characteristics that distinguish Chick-fil-A Inc. from other quick-service restaurant companies, the most notable and the most asked about tradition is that of closing all of its 1,480-plus restaurants on Sunday. Following is a brief explanation of how the closed-on-Sunday policy started and why it'll continue to remain in place. Since Truett Cathy, founder and CEO of Chick-fil-A, opened his first restaurant in 1946, he's made his closed-on-Sunday policy as much a part of the Chick-fil-A brand as the original Chick-fil-A chicken sandwich. While many question the chain's policy and how Chick-fil-A could forego sales on one of the busiest days for food service, you know, that was my question. Kathy answers challengers by saying closing on Sunday is one of the best business decisions he has ever made. Kathy's practice of closing restaurants is unique to the restaurant business and a testament to his faith in God. Within the first week of business at his Dwarf Grill restaurant in Hapeville, Georgia, I'm not making this up, more than 60 years ago, Kathy knew that he would not deal with money on the Lord's Day. Today, the closed-on-Sunday policy is reflected in the company's corporate purpose. To glorify God by being a faithful steward of all that is entrusted to us, to have a positive influence on all who come in contact with us, Kathy believes that being closed on Sundays says two important things to people. One, that there must be something special about the way Chick-fil-A people view their spiritual life. And two, that there must be something special about how Chick-fil-A feels about its people. Kathy believes that by giving employees Sunday off as a day for family, worship, fellowship, or rest, the company attracts quality people. And people, he says, are the cornerstone of all that the company does as a chain. Chick-fil-A is the opportunity to attract individuals who want to be associated with an organization with a values-based vision, purpose-driven, and that truly values a balance between work and family. In today's business world, this closed-on-Sunday policy may seem a costly business decision, but as sales figures have consistently proven, Chick-fil-A restaurants generate more business per square foot in 6 days than many other quick-service restaurants produce in seven. Chick-fil-A generated more than $3.2 billion in sales in 2009. The chain has enjoyed sales gains for 42 consecutive years, every year since the first restaurant opened in 1967. Kathy credits blessings from the Lord for the great success the company enjoys, and he remains as committed as ever to maintaining the closed-on-Sunday policy. I feel it's the best business decision I ever made, says Kathy. Well, I'll be darned. A fast food company that stands on principle and observes Shabbat, even if it's a day late every week. You know, coming as this did about 2 weeks after Jack Lew, an observant Orthodox Jew, was appointed White House Chief of Staff, which raised questions for some people about his ability to fulfill a ridiculously demanding job while also keeping Shabbat, it triggered a consideration of just what it takes to preserve this central Jewish principle, a day of rest each week. The truth is that as a congregational rabbi, I do a pretty bad job of keeping Shabbat. After all, While I can preach to my congregants about the essential need we all have to take true time off, to observe a day of rest and worship and family and peace, guess who works virtually every single Shabbos? That's right, the rabbi. There really isn't a single day of the week when the rabbi or cantor's work isn't considered to be more essential, in fact, than Shabbat. We run the services, conduct bar bat mitzvahs, read Torah, preach, lead singing, teach, socialize with congregants, listen to people's problems, attend kiddush lunches where we are essentially continuing to conduct temple business, and generally work our hardest days on Saturday. This past Shabbat yesterday, I also officiated at a bris, a ritual circumcision. I didn't do the cutting, I just led the prayers and schmoozed, and visited some people in the hospital, a normal Shabbat for me. Basically, although we talk a good game about Shabbat, even we rabbis don't really preserve it. And yet here's a fast food chain dedicated to, well, making money, managing to do so, and to preserve its employees' rights to do so, and claiming that's a big part of its huge success. Frankly, that's pretty inspirational. Because in a constantly wired world in which everyone is supposed to be available instantly all the time, isn't it a great thing to find an entire company, a huge one, that actually observes one of the great Jewish inventions of all time, the Shabbat? And if Chick-fil-A can manage to keep Shabbos, why the heck can't the rest of us? As Senator Joe Lieberman famously said, he was committed to serving his country 24/6. Can we learn to do the same? And if we can, will we derive some of the same benefits this huge corporation believes that it has? I guess these aren't really rhetorical questions, but rather a kind of challenge. Why can't we keep Shabbat? Isn't a day without devices, free of the rush and race that destroy peace of mind, more important than any of our other mundane tasks and chores? Well, to play us in this morning, here's a lovely version of the Shabbat hymn, Shalom Aleichem, Peace to You, Angels of Peace, as sung by the Jewish-Brazilian international music star Fortuna, about the Sabbath, you know, that day we need to observe. Shalom Aleichem, Malachei Yashanim, Malachei Elyon, Yim Melech, Malachei Amalachim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Bochem Leshalom, Malachei Yashalom, Malachei Elyon, Malachei Malachim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Bochem Leshalom, Malachei Shalom, Malachei Elyon. Yim Melech, Malachei Malachim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Malachei Yashanim, Malachei Elyon, That was Fortuna singing Shalom Aleichem for, well, Shabbat, which comes up in only 6 more days. This time, let's really rest and rejuvenate. Our guest this morning, Ambassador Nancy Brinker, is the founder and CEO of the Susan G. Komen for the Cure Foundation, which has done more for breast cancer research and awareness than any other organization in the world. Her story is touching and powerful. Hear it when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, the great Italian philosopher Antonio Garaducci once said, "To find balance in life is to find happiness." Now, I assume he was a smart guy, being a philosopher and all. So it gets me to thinking, balance is probably a good thing when it comes to pizza, too. You know, just the right amount of sauce, cheese, crust, and toppings. But consider this. What one mama's customer might think is just the right amount of something, another customer might think is too much or too little. That's why at Mama's we balance every item we make to each individual customer's taste. Extra cheese or light cheese? Heavy on the sauce or easy on the sauce? Crispy crust or lightly done crust? It's all in balance for each customer. And as Garaducci says, balance equals happiness, and that equals loyal Mama's customers. So I'd say that, on balance, that's a pretty good situation. Mama's Pizza with 4 convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Ready to move your child to an outstanding private school? Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA, is accepting a limited number of enrollments for January 2012, mid-year. THA's kindergarten through 8th grade integrated curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, thereby providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes even, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. THA graduates capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter high school, ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. A great education is more affordable than you think, and the best education comes from THA. Space is limited. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Ambassador Nancy Brinker, the founder and CEO of the Susan G. Komen for the Cure organization, named after her only sister, Susan, who died from breast cancer at the age of 36 in 1980. Nancy Brinker was also the United States Ambassador to Hungary from 2001 to 2003 and Chief of Protocol for the United States from 2007 to the end of the George W. Bush administration. A breast cancer survivor herself, she uses her experience to heighten understanding of the disease. Her organization, the Susan G. Komen for the Cure Foundation, has raised since its inception over $1.9 billion for research, education, and health services, making it the largest breast cancer charity in the world. Her new book is called Promise Me, and it is touching and moving, and we're delighted to welcome you this morning. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. It's so nice to be with you today.
So nice to have you here. I should note, of course, that you're Jewish, that you belong to a synagogue in Dallas. All of those things, of course, the most important things we can say about you. But I'm going to kind of come at it from a sideways angle. How did your Jewish background influence your work with the Komen Foundation?
Well, you know, I grew up in Peoria, Illinois. And so that's where I was my first exposure to our religion. My mother always took us to, we went to temple, and we were members of it. Our temple was, at the time, Ann Shiamith, was located in a Baptist church. And one of the greatest lessons that that ever taught me was that it was possible for people of different faiths to share the same building and to share work and share things, and how it meant, how it was to be a very small Jewish community in a community where largely everyone was either Christian or of the Catholic faith. So it was a very interesting and a wonderful opportunity to grow up with our values and to understand how important it was. And of course, at our temple, we often had really wonderful lessons in tzedakah, tikkun olam, and all the other principles that we practice as Jews and try to, and lessons and learning. And we had many, multiple opportunities to become in become involved in community events, Jewish organizations, Jewish youth groups.
All powerful influences. Tell us briefly how the Komen Foundation started.
Well, Susan Komen, who was my older sister and my best friend, developed breast cancer at the age of 33 in 1978. Its times were very, very different. And let me preface it by telling you that growing up in Peoria, there were many lessons we learned from our faith, but also our mother and father's concern about the community and mother's understanding of stewardship and the ability of one person to make a difference, and that each of us had that obligation to do so. So every Saturday, Susie and I would have to go with mother as she volunteered at yet another of her charities, and we learned very early on that we were not going to get to go swimming or do anything else until we did our community service. So Susie and I spent a number of years doing things and really learning to love and enjoy them. That's how we got started. And when she went away to college and I went a different direction, through everything, we were the best of friends and very close. And then when she was diagnosed with breast cancer, we found yet one more terrible thing that we had to deal with and that we had to fix and change the course of the disease for millions of people who would be diagnosed with it. She died in 1980 at the age of 36, leaving two children and a loving community behind. And right before she died, she asked me if I would do something, if I would spend my life curing this disease so that other families didn't have to lose people this way and that we could find treatments and opportunities for people to know they had it and to be diagnosed and to be able to discuss it and live with it, not die from it.
A tremendous story, and we'll hear much more from Ambassador Nancy Brinker, who's the author of Promise Me, How a Sister's Love Launched the Global Movement to End Breast Cancer, the founder of the Komen Foundation, when we come back on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org. Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, twojewishradio.com, or download us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. The Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage Trip to Israel with Rabbi Sam Kohan is set for May 30th to June 10th, 2012. If you're interested in going with us on this fantastic journey to Israel, email twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 at Temple Emmanuel for more information and an itinerary. We welcome the return of a favorite segment here on Two Jewish, our occasional Jewish poetry slam. Here's a new poet for Two Jewish, Marty Cohen. Good morning, Marty.
Good morning. Good morning, Rabbi.
So what prompts you to write poetry?
I don't know. I was on a trip up in Greer, and one morning I just got up, sat down on the porch as where we were staying, and just started writing. And after 3 hours, I looked down and I realized I had come up with a whole series of different poems. I'd never done this before. And after I got back to Green Valley, all of a sudden I started continuing the writing, and it just came from out of the blue.
This poem is called Bagel. When did you write it?
This was approximately a year and a half ago.
And it's still got a hole in the middle.
Still has a hole in the middle.
Let's hear it.
The essence of the bagel is the hole. Without it, there would be no bagel. The hole is the soul of the bagel. Fill the hole with cream cheese or lox, Jewish soul food, and you still have a bagel. A roll has no hole. Is it a bagel without a soul? But a hole is simply an empty space. It's nothing. But even in its nothingness, it is infinite and everything. Imagine the torus of bread. Like the body, it encompasses its soul. As the bagel cannot exist without its whole, the body needs its soul in order to be. The bagel is the Jewish experience. Look at it. See it as one. Hold it. Smell its freshness. Taste it, chew it, devour it, digest it, and allow it to become the essence of your being.
I do not think any of us will think of a bagel in quite the same way again. Thanks, Marty. We'll do it again.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Good morning, Guy.
Boker Tov.
Boker Tov. Well, there are some wonderful artists coming from Israel. Israel is a fantastic place for contemporary art. Tell us a little bit about this project, how it originated, and what it involves.
Yes, I'm actually very excited, very excited. As you well know, we have a partnership region in Israel with the area of Chof Ashkelon and Kiryat Malachi through a Jewish agency project of Partnership Together. Our partnership is called TIPS, Tucson, Israel, Phoenix, and Seattle, which is actually five communities, because two in Israel.
Which are right next to each other, of course, Seattle and Tucson.
Yeah, Seattle and Tucson have the same weather.
Yeah, exactly. Same kind of place.
And we are bringing over a mission of artists from Israel. One of them is a world-famous papier-mâché artist. Her work was presented at the London Museum, at New York Contemporary Arts Museum, and in many other locations. Another artist is a mosaic artist. A third one is an artist that specializes in teaching teachers how to use arts when they teach, and also in working through arts with children with special needs and disabilities. And the third one is kind of, she's doing everything. She's doing jewelry, she's doing painting, she's doing murals. She's amazing. Altogether, we're bringing those four artists. They will give different workshops all across Tucson. They will do a very big project with THA. They will also lead our Tu B'Shvat party on February 9th, which we'll probably talk about next week.
When we talk about Tu B'Shvat.
When we talk about Tu B'Shvat. And they're also doing an interesting program with teenagers from southern Tucson, teenagers that come from neighborhoods that are, well, I would say a little more challenging.
Sure.
And they will kind of try and help them to express themselves through the arts and to find this connection. And you know, for me, it's a different way of bringing Israel, because people see Israel only on the news. They open it, they think Israel is only bombs and rockets and terrorists. And the truth is that the day-to-day life are totally different. And art is very significant in Israel. Creating works, doing sculptures, painting and stuff like that. Being creative is a very strong element of Israel culture. We can see it at arts, and we can see it at the high-tech industry on the other side, being creative.
Why do you think Israel has been such a dynamic place for contemporary art? You know, after all, when we think of Jewish tradition, we don't think about images being presented. It's against the Second Commandment and so on. And yet, really, it's a very dynamic place.
I think there are several reasons, and probably the same elements that brought Israel to be such a successful high-tech country are the same elements that brought it to be such successful in contemporary arts. One thing is the culture that allows a lot of free speech and allow people to express themselves without hierarchy, without being afraid of what other people will think about them. Another element is, of course, the immigration. A lot of immigrants from different countries bring a lot of cultures, and that kind of meld together into interesting fusion. A third element would probably be, you know, in some ways, the stress element of life. When you live on the edge,
you tend to be more creative, don't you?
Yeah, you need to express yourself. And those women that we bring, they live at Chof Ashkelon and Kiryat Malachi. They get rockets from the Gaza Strip nearly on a daily basis. Sometimes, you know, they might go out and bath their baby in the bathtub, and suddenly the alarm goes off.
Right, and then they've got to get going.
Pick her up and run to the bomb shelter. So arts is a way to cool down.
Well, you know? Great description, and it should be a terrific program. We'll look forward to it. Thanks, Guy.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Now, this is a really obvious question to ask, but what's cooking at Janos?
Greatness, wonderful food, wonderful flavors, great experiences, beautiful atmosphere, terrific views. That's about it.
You know, I have to say, it is really one of the most magnificent restaurant experiences you can have, not just in the Southwest, but in the world.
Well, thanks, Rabbi. You know, we have three restaurants now, but Janos is the flagship. That's where we put everything into it. All the elegance, all of the love, all of the caring. That's the peak of what we do.
So for a very special night, or just because you want to have a spectacular meal, how can they get in touch with you?
Just give us a call, 615-6100. Go to our website, www.janos.com. We'll be happy to see you.
That's janos.com. Thanks, Janos.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, you were just back from Bulgaria on a long journey in the middle of winter. Bulgarian Jewish community has a pretty long history and an interesting one and a surprising one in many ways.
Yeah, Bulgaria itself has a pretty long, interesting, and surprising history, and Jews have been part of it for a very long time. I think the bulk of today's Jewish community can trace its roots to the expulsion from Spain, and so many of them are Sephardic Jews with origins way back in Spain or Portugal, who came via the Ottoman Empire, of which Bulgaria was a part until 1878. And by the way, their Independence Day, or their National Day, when they won independence from the Turks, was March 3rd, 1878. So when I was there as a diplomat, it was always nice. People remembered my birthday because it was the same as Bulgaria's birthday. And it was an easy thing to remember. Bulgaria was exceptionally good to its Jews during World War II. The king and the archbishop, or whatever he was, of the Orthodox Church of Bulgaria took a united stand, telling the Nazis that, you know, Jews were Bulgarians too, and they couldn't have them, basically.
And the Bulgarians were allies, really, of the Nazis.
Yes, they were. And they were the only ones who really stood up to them, although some people fault them for not protecting the Jews who were under their control then, but in the Macedonian regions that had not always been Bulgaria. So they sort of had
two standards, maybe.
Yes, sort of two classes of Jews. Real Bulgarians who couldn't be touched and who were saved, by and large. I mean, like 99%.
Yeah, the highest percentage of any country in Europe.
And then this other category of Jews in sort of what even the Bulgarians themselves considered was kind of occupied territory as a result of previous wars. You know, there were two Balkan wars in 1912 and 1913, and then World War One, and the borders kept changing. And even today, the border zone where Greece, Turkey, and Bulgaria come together is quite sensitive. In the communist times, that was one of the most heavily fortified borders in the world. It was NATO directly confronting the Warsaw Pact and a heavy Soviet presence. Today, it's not quite as fortified, but it is a key choke point for all road transport and commerce between Asia and Europe. So all these trucks from Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and points further east or south transit through this one little choke point and then go on a tiny two-lane road from this border point to Plovdiv, which is Bulgaria's second city, historically known as Philippopolis. It's named after King Philip of Macedon, the father of Alexander the Great. And Plovdiv itself has had a very old Jewish community, really since Greek and Roman times. We can talk, I guess, next week about the modern state of the Jewish community there and the degree to which Bulgarians are or are not anti-Semitic and the important posts that certain Jews have occupied in modern Bulgaria history.
Not a history most of us are too familiar with, although some may know the story of King Boris protecting the Jews. We'll talk much more about Bulgaria and other points next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. The time had arrived for Moshe to take Leah to the hospital so their first baby could be born. Upon arrival, the doctor told them he'd invented a new machine that would transfer a portion of the mother's labor pain to the father instead. He asked if they were willing to try it out, and they agreed. The doctor started with the pain transfer dial at 10%, explaining that even 10% was probably more pain than Moshe had ever experienced in his life. But as labor progressed, Moshe felt fine. He asked the doctor to bump it up a notch, and so the doctor adjusted the machine to a 20% pain transfer to the father. Moshe was still feeling fine. The doctor checked Moshe's blood pressure, was amazed at what he was doing. They decided to try for a 50% pain transfer from the mother to the father. Moshe continued to feel well. Since it was obviously helping Leah considerably, Moshe encouraged the doctor to transfer all the pain to him, and he did. And Leah delivered a healthy baby with virtually no pain. Leah and Moshe were both ecstatic. What a fantastic device. Unfortunately, when they got home, they found the mailman lying dead at the front door. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and not suffer any pain. This week we read the wonderful Torah portion of Bishalach, the great tale of the Exodus from Egypt. The story is familiar from Bible class, sermons, Passover Seders, movies, cartoons, Sunday school, and so on. The Israelites, under the leadership of Moses, with help from his brother Aaron and even his sister Miriam, have been liberated from Egyptian slavery. God has sent the 10 plagues to destroy the will of the oppressors, and now our people escapes Egypt after 400 years of slavery with small bundles of clothing, some unleavened bread baked in haste, and a few trinkets of gold and silver borrowed from their former slavers. The Israelites approach the sea, some say the Sea of Reeds, some the Red Sea, and Pharaoh has a change of heart and mind. He decides cruelly to follow the Israelites with his chariot army and re-enslave them. Stuck on the shore of the sea between the oncoming enemy and the deep waters, God miraculously saves the Israelites by dividing the sea and allowing them to cross on dry land, with the waters closing up behind them to destroy their Egyptian pursuers. As they look back on the now unparted waters, the Israelites celebrate and sing a great song. Who is like you, God, among the gods who are worshipped? Who is like you, adorned in holiness, awesome in praise, doing wonders? You know, that song is now part of every evening and morning service in Jewish tradition, the Micha Mocha, often upbeat, joyous, energizing. For in that very moment, our people fully comprehended the miraculous saving power of God, the amazing ability to be redeemed from death and destruction. Well, it doesn't always turn out that way. It does remind us that in Jewish belief, God can do anything and has done so for our people in rare and remarkable times. It's not something we can count on in daily life. Although David Ben-Gurion, the founding prime minister of Israel and the true father of the country, memorably said, "In Israel, in order to be a realist, you must believe in miracles." And that capacity exists and is actualized in this portion to demonstrate that freedom can come even to the most downtrodden and enslaved people in the world. Now, Ben-Gurion also said, anyone who doesn't believe you can't change history has never written his own memoirs. One of the great aspects of this portion of Beshalach is that as soon as the story of the Exodus and the crossing of the sea is told in prose, there's an immediate reinterpretation in poetry. And we have been reinterpreting this fantastic tale ever since. We'll do it again, not only this Shabbat, but on Passover. It's all very close to the heart of Judaism and Jewish life. And it is also a wonderful lesson that's been taken to heart by nearly every liberation movement since the Exodus over 3,000 years ago. No matter how dark the prospect for freedom may seem, sometimes, often, God makes it possible for slaves to indeed become free. When we come back on Too Jewish, our extraordinary guest, Ambassador Nancy Brinker, founder and CEO of the Susan G. Komen Foundation for the Cure, will explain what motivates her to continue to work to cure breast cancer all around the world, and also what the Chief Protocol Officer for the President of the United States does, and how those two roles are related. All that when we return in a few moments on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to receive dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations. This allows them to provide scholarship for kids in K-12 at qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA. If you pay Arizona state taxes and make your donation today before December 31st, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax. Your contributions last year helped more than 100 children receive the financial aid they needed to get a Jewish education. Join over 750 supporters who gave up to $1,000 per couple $500 per individual as a tax credit, and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. You can do it on your credit card, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of Jewish education.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, a friend and frequent guest of Two Jewish, resigned her seat in Congress last week, a little over a year after she was shot in the terrible attack on January 8, 2011, saying that she needed to continue to work on her own recovery and that she wanted the best representation for her beloved state of Arizona, and promising an eventual return to public life. Gabby recorded a beautiful message that aired last week after personally appearing here in Tucson at the memorial services and events commemorating that tough one-year anniversary. The Forward newspaper named her the most influential Jewish person in the world last year. Gabby Giffords has been an exceptional representative, but more than that, she has always been a warm, kind, and principled person, and now she is an extraordinary inspiration as well. We wish her a refuah shlema, a full healing from that terrible trauma. May she continue to go from strength to strength in this recovery. We have been blessed by her presence and her service. We hope it happens again. In Atlanta, the owner and publisher of the Atlanta Jewish Times has resigned and is seeking a buyer in the wake of a column he wrote speculating that Israel would consider assassinating President Obama. Andrew Adler announced last week he is relinquishing all day-to-day activities effective immediately following the publishing of his opinion piece, saying that Obama's assassination was among Israel's options in heading off a nuclear Iran. Adler said he would publish an apology in the next edition and that reaction from readers had been overwhelmingly negative. Imagine that. The Jewish Federation of Greater Atlanta said earlier it would suspend its relationship with the Atlanta Jewish Times until Adler removed himself from the newspaper's operations. Federation also called on him to sell the weekly. While we acknowledge his public apology and remorse, the damage done to the people of Israel, the global Jewish people, and especially the Jewish community of Atlanta is irreparable, the Federation said. In a January 13th column, Adler outlined what he said were three possible responses by Israel to Iran's acquiring a nuclear weapon. Preemptive strike against Hamas and Hezbollah, terrorist groups, he said, would be emboldened by a nuclear Iran, a direct strike on Iran, and three, give the go-ahead for a U.S.-based Mossad agent to take out a president deemed unfriendly to Israel in order for the current vice president to take his place and forcefully dictate that the United States policy includes helping the Jewish state obliterate its enemies. He continued, "Yes, you read three correctly. Order a hit on a president in order to preserve Israel's existence. Think about it. If I have thought of this Tom Clancy-type scenario, don't you think that this almost unfathomable idea has been discussed in Israel's most inner circles?" Well, frankly, no, I don't think that. The Anti-Defamation League and the National Jewish Democratic Council also condemned Adler for his column. David Harris, the executive director of the American Jewish Committee and a former guest of Two Jewish, also called on Adler to resign. CNN reports that the Secret Service is investigating Adler over his column. What a complete idiot this Adler is on so many levels. I'm not sure how else I can describe him, but his resignation, at least, counts as good news. In Beirut, Lebanese military intelligence has arrested a man accused of spying for Israel and Lebanon for the past 35 years. The alleged spy was identified as Elias Yunus, a retired employee of the Ogero telecommunications company. The Hezbollah news agency Al-Manar referred to Yunus as the dean of all collaborators because of his alleged decades-long collaboration with Israel. Yunus supplied the enemy, that's how Hezbollah refers to Israel, with details regarding marine security and gave them information related to the telecommunications ministry. Lebanon has arrested several people working in the telecommunications industry in the past for allegedly spying for Israel. They have also accused Israel of planting espionage devices in southern Lebanon. That part I do believe. And that's the news of Jews around the world. Our brothers, our brothers. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Nancy Goodman Brinker, the founder and CEO of the Susan G. Komen for the Cure Foundation, which has raised $1.9 billion for research, education, and health services, the largest breast cancer charity in the world. She has more, well, not she, but the Komen Foundation has more than 75,000 volunteers nationwide, 120 affiliates in the U.S., three affiliates in other countries, constantly growing and working to come up with treatments and a cure and awareness for breast cancer. You know, your book, Promise Me, is a really a touching memoir and very personal. Tell us the first, you know, when somebody makes a promise like that, really a deathbed promise, you talked about earlier in the show with your sister saying, you know, please do something to stop other families from having to experience this. What's the first thing you do?
The first thing you do is you have to understand, you have to learn about this disease. You can't just be a side. You can't just assume that you are that you know what, you know, you've heard something. You have to become educated about it. And fortunately today on the internet, there is so much information, a lot of it very good on all the websites and a lot of it not so good. We at Susan G. Komen pride ourselves, Komen.org, with having a website that is very valuable to people. So that's the first thing. And then, of course, you become, if you're lucky, what you want to be is involved in a breast cancer community. And that's what we provide, again, at Susan G. Komen, a real breast cancer community. So and you can learn, and then you become active and proactive in the management of your disease. This is not easy. It is scary. It is frightening. There are lots of ups and downs as dealing with it. But I will tell you one thing, that it has become a much, much different situation in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years than it was 30 years ago when we started this organization, when people couldn't really discuss this disease out loud.
Now people talk about it. Ball players wear pink shoes. Bases are pink in baseball games. Football players wear pink uniforms. It's really a different world. And it seems to me that Komen Foundation, that your work has really made that possible.
Well, we believed and we always realized we had to deliver very conventional messages in unconventional ways. And, you know, when we started this organization, we couldn't, you couldn't really talk about breast cancer out loud. There were no 1-800 numbers. There were no, you know,
websites,
computers. There was no websites. There were no 1-800 numbers to call. As I said, there were no communities of breast cancer patients and advocacy to reach or interact with to understand what you had and to get resources in place. It was a very, very quiet, lonely environment if you were a breast cancer patient. And so we set out to change that, and we set out to talk about this disease in ways people had never talked about them. And you know, you couldn't use the word breast in most newspapers, magazines, or TV. So we had to have a way to talk about it, and that's when we started Race for the Cure, and that's when we began pairing the breast cancer messages with products.
You know, the corporate tie-in has been so important and so extraordinary. Were you really, I don't know if this is true, but were you one of the pioneers of doing that?
Well, we were. You know, we had a predecessor. I think there was an American Express program for the Statue of Liberty in the late 80s, or the early 80s.
Right.
And I had seen that. Actually, it was in the late 70s, and I had seen that.
Was that Lee Iacocca?
And that was really the very first program in my memory. And I saw that and realized that there had to be a way to utilize the tremendous power of branding to discuss this issue and to catch people, if you will, a little off guard. In other words, these messages were so frightening to people that there had to be a way that we could reach them and break through, and that's exactly what happened. It took a lot of time. It took years before it worked, but then we did it, and it was very successful.
You know, I have to admit a personal connection. My grandmother, my bubby, my mom, and both my sisters are breast cancer survivors.
Wow.
And, you know, we'd never had cancer before that, and then suddenly it seemed like everybody had gone through it. This is a very common experience. What percentage of American women contract breast cancer, and how many are cured?
Well, over 200,000 today, and over 60,000 die every year. Not diagnosed maybe the same year, but it is a second leading cancer killer of women in America. And it is growing in a really dramatic way around the world, unfortunately. And where we are, China, some of the Latin American countries, Sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, all the work of Susan G. Komen, this is where we are, and this is what we often see, and this is where we fight. We go to places that are unpopular sometimes. We go where we're needed, and because breast cancer is becoming a very, very large disease.
Do you, are there areas of the world that you would like to have a larger presence?
I'd like us to be, you know, we're as I said, already in the Middle East, in Israel, and in a lot of the Arabic countries, the Gulf states. But I like to see us in some of the, and we're in Central Europe, we're in Russia. And oftentimes we partner with the Joint Distribution Fund of the Jewish Charities to do that work. So we're just in some amazing places, and I'd like us to continue to go to places, again, that we can help, build communities of breast cancer patients to help fight this disease.
How would your sister feel about what you've accomplished in her name?
Well, you know, I don't know. I've got to believe she would have been extraordinarily excited. I am very excited that her name still sits atop the largest breast cancer organization in the world. I'm very excited about that. I'm excited about all that we've been able to do. I'm still, however, not excited about, you know, the fact that it seems like things still go very slow. I want things to move quicker. I want more therapy in the pipeline that is more accessible, lower cost. You know, those are the things that I'm looking for.
One final question. You received the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2009. Was that your greatest honor?
Yes, it was truly, truly the greatest honor you can imagine. And it was amazing. And I was... I was surprised. I was just thrilled. I was thrilled.
I want to thank Nancy Brinker for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Her book is called Promise Me, How a Sister's Love Launched the Global Movement to End Breast Cancer. And you can find out a great deal more about the Komen Foundation, komen.org, online. Thank you for all that you do.
Thank you very much, Rabbi, for having me, and lots of good luck to you.
Thank you. When we come back, we hear about next week's guest. Get a final musical playout on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday morning at 9 a.m. when our guest will be the best-selling mystery author, Faye Kellerman, who has a new book out. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website. And like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning for this coming Shabbat of the Song of Moses at the Sea comes from an unusual source, Bob Marley's Redemption Song, based on the first great redemption song in the Torah this week. My friends, may you be blessed with a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Old pirates, yes, they rabbi, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit, but my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing songs of freedom, 'cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery, none but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Ooh, some say it's just a part of it, we've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I